It's your time to Ed Up with America's leading higher education podcast network, the Ed Up Experience, where we make education your business. This is Ed Up Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. She's Dean at St. Mary's School of Law, and she's going to be leading conversations about legal education in today's world. Now let's hear from your host, Patty Roberts.
Welcome to Ed Up Legal. I'm Patty Roberts, and I'm at St. Mary's University School of Law. Today's guest is Jennifer Gerarda Brown. She has served as Dean and Professor of Law of the Quinnipiac University School of Law since 2013. Welcome, Dean Brown.
Thank you, Patty. I'm really happy to be here, and I appreciate the chance to talk with you.
Well, I'm so excited to speak with you as well. You are a new dean to me because there aren't all that many deans I know, given the pandemic nature of our job. And so maybe you can start by telling me a little bit about your journey to the deanship.
Sure. Thank you. So I joined the Quinnipiac Law School faculty in 1994. I came to Quinnipiac from Emory, where I had been on the faculty. And when my spouse, whose name is Ian Ayers, and he's on the faculty at Yale, when we got married and we were looking for a place where we could be and two schools close together, Ian had a wonderful offer at Yale, and I was able to get a wonderful offer at Quinnipiac. And so we came to the greater New Haven, Connecticut area, and we've been here ever since. A few years into my time as a professor at Quinnipiac, we created a center on dispute resolution, and I was given the chance to be the sort of inaugural director of that center. And it started very small and in sort of humble ways. So a few years into my time on the faculty, we decided to start a center on dispute resolution, and I was given the chance to be the inaugural director. And it just began in sort of small ways. We created a Society for Dispute Resolution. That would have been in the late 90s. We collaborated with University of Connecticut on training, which eventually just came completely in-house to Quinnipiac, and now it's a 40-hour certificate training in mediation. And we started this really wonderful workshop in collaboration with Yale Law School that has run continuously since about 1994. And we've been able to bring in, you know, really terrific speakers from around the country, really, who speak at Quinnipiac and at Yale on dispute resolution. And that's actually been interesting during COVID, because we've taken that virtual, which has actually expanded the audience for the workshop in interesting ways. But, I had time on the faculty. I had a little bit of administrative experience from running the center. And as I thought about whether to apply for the deanship, and I actually agonized about it for a long time, because I just loved being a professor, and I love teaching and writing and all the things that professors get to do. And I ultimately decided, after I wrote my letter of interest — it was the process of writing the letter of interest, where I had to kind of, you know, lay out what would be a vision for this law school, what direction might it go to build on its strengths and to do something meaningful. And when I actually wrote that, I thought, wow, I do have a reason to want to be dean of this law school. And I was able, I think, to channel just some love I had. I mean, that's one of the great advantages of being an internal candidate for a deanship. You know the place, and hopefully you love the place, and you can really channel that love into the application process and ultimately into deaning there. So that was my journey. And I actually didn't think I would get the job. Each, phase of the search, when they would call me and say, the search firm guy would call and say, "Well, congratulations, you made it to the next round." I was so shocked, because I just didn't think an internal candidate would be what would be competitive. And then ultimately I got the offer. So that's been the journey. And, I think there have definitely been ups and downs along the way, but I would say, with certainty, that the fact that I love the institution and I love the people in it has helped me so often when there are difficult things to do and times are tough. It really makes a difference. So I feel pretty lucky to have that.
Well, that's wonderful. And I'm not surprised that the process of going through the drafting the letter of intent to apply really helped you hone in on whether this was something that you wanted, because you really have to make the case that, as you indicated, the vision, but also why it is you are the right person to lead the institution forward. So that's terrific. And apparently they agree with you since you've been doing the job since 2013. I'm glad you're enjoying it. During that time, you were an internal candidate. So great, you didn't have to get to know a lot of additional personalities. You already had the trust of your colleagues, I'm sure. You've taught a lot of students. So, you know, there were a lot of alums who already knew you. But then you throw in a global pandemic that nobody had experienced before. So how was that adjustment for you and your law school?
Right. Yeah. So here's the tricky thing for me in answering that question. When the pandemic hit in, you know, February and March of 2020, I was not technically dean of the law school at that time. I was serving as interim provost at Quinnipiac. And so I was over in the provost's office, and my wonderful colleague and the former dean, the dean who preceded me, Brad Saxton, had stepped back in as interim dean. And so Brad was on the front lines of handling the law students, the law faculty, all the scheduling issues. And, you know, he and I were in probably daily contact, but I was seeing it more, you know, from the provost's office. And that is, I would say, one step removed from the kind of day-to-day operational complexities of dealing with COVID and the curriculum and testing and moving on to Zoom and all those things that my colleagues dealt with, you know, on the front lines, on the ground. So I was a step removed from that, but I was many steps closer to the kind of conversations that were happening with the president and, you know, the chief financial officer and the head of facilities and, you know, all those folks on the management committee of the university, as well as my fellow provosts at other colleges and universities in Connecticut, because we were in probably weekly contact, you know, just trying to compare notes and figuring out what people were doing. So it was a strange mix. And I will say, I have so much appreciation for my colleagues who dealt with the individual student stress, illness, you know, loss, these problems that people were all going through. And I will also say, though they won't ever really be aware of it, I as provost, I definitely took one for the team, more than one for the team, in having to talk with parents about, gosh, you know, everything from when are we going to get my child's belongings that they had to leave in their dorm room? We never were able to come back. And when are you going to let us do that? And I mean, that level of kind of interaction was new to me when I was working as provost. It was sort of at that level. And then as we started to plan for the fall, and this would have been more like at the tail end of my time as provost, because I had decided I wanted to come back to the law school. So I was planning to come back to the law school in late summer 2020, but I was still provost while we were planning for the fall of 2020. And, you know, all these issues around hybrid education, not only in the law school, but across the university, I was having to deal with. And it's definitely the case that we had difficulties with that in law schools. But I will say, you know, we generally didn't have to figure out how to run a bio lab or how to do physical therapy education in a hybrid mode and how to get all of the students tested so they can go back into clinical placements in nursing or medicine. So anyway, I don't mean to make too much of that time as interim provost, except that it kind of helped me to keep things in perspective as I came back to the law school, because as difficult as things can be, and they are more difficult when you have to deal with the individual faculty and students and staff, and deans are on the front lines of that, helping to see how COVID was hitting other schools in the university helped me, I think, be more supportive of the provost, more supportive of my fellow deans, and to try not to whine about how difficult things were in the law school.
That law school exceptionalism that we're always arguing, right, with the university.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. It makes me think I should suggest to our new provost that we all do a little rotation, each dean do a little rotation in the provost's office.
Or just even shadowing them for a week. You know, I think we'd see, you know, just the volume of email that comes through that's completely unmanageable, I think, for a provost, depending on the size and complexity of the university. It's really quite different.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I'm sure the law school was very happy to get you back. And I wanted to focus on the law school a little bit now. One thing that I found very interesting that you shared with me is that you all do a 24-hour retreat for your students called Beginner's Wisdom, Integrating Personal and Professional Values. And I'd love for you to tell us who that's for, when it happens, why you started it, what the results have been. I think that's probably unusual, at least with the schools that I have heard about and deans I've talked to. I've not heard of a 24-hour retreat at any other law school yet.
Well, part of the idea came from students who were research assistants for me on I was working on a project before I became dean that was going to be a kind of guided journal to take people through the first year that would provide them a series of journaling prompts and get them to kind of reflect on what was happening in the classroom and provide, you know, sort of inspirational ideas or quotes that they could then sort of integrate into their own processing of what was happening to them. Because I really have always been interested in the way people integrate their personal and their professional values, this whole idea of professional identity. And, you know, as I tell our 1Ls, as you start to think like a lawyer, I want you to continue to feel like a human being. And so I was working.
I love that. I'm sure all the families of 1Ls love that too.
Oh, they like to hear that. Yeah. And I actually enlist their help in that. So I'll just say this one more thing and then I'll get back to beginner's wisdom. But we do a thing, as many schools do, I'm sure, at the end of orientation for our 1Ls. We sort of administer an oath of professionalism. And we invite their family and friends to come and watch them take that oath. And then we do a nice reception out on the lawn. And I always tell the families before we administer the oath that they can be our partners in sort of helping our students continue to feel like human beings, because maybe, you know, later in the semester or maybe sometime in the second year, I ask them to just check in with their student and sort of tell them, like, what are they observing about how this person is growing and changing? I mean, it may be for the better, may not always be for the better, but that people who know and love them before they come to law school can be really instrumental in helping them to retain that, you know, some of the best elements of their core identity as they're acquiring this professional identity. So I've been interested in that for quite a while, even before I became dean. And my research assistants who were helping me, you know, kind of gather materials and think of prompts said, God, it'd be so cool if we could just get away for 24 hours and talk to each other about this kind of stuff. And when I heard them say that, I remembered how Len Riskin, who was at Missouri and who has long been a leader of mindfulness in legal education, used to do retreats with folks from Yale. I know Harlan Dalton was one who would go off on retreat. And I think they were focused very much on mindfulness with the students. And I don't know how much they really talked about professional identity. I never went on one of those retreats, but I knew they had done them. I thought it sounded so great. So the students and I decided to try this out. And I think it was in the fall of 2012. So it has been now just 10 iterations of this that we've done. We've done one just about every year, either in the spring or in the fall. We started in the fall and then we moved to the spring, thinking that one else might be able to join us more easily in the spring than they do would be able to in the fall. It's too early. So who's it for? It's for law students, 1Ls through 3Ls or 4Ls in our case, since we have a part-time program. We also invite faculty, we invite some staff and alumni, particularly alumni who have gone on the retreat when they're students. We just go away to a place, we've done different places, but recently we've gone to a place that's a summer camp in the summer, has heated buildings in the winter and a nice dining hall, really good food. And it's, you know, very simple. And for 24 hours, we do some meditation. We have some conversations around change and how people change in law school, how they feel about those changes. Lately, students also want to talk, I think, a fair amount about isolation and loneliness and how difficult it can be to kind of break through the game face that a lot of people keep, kind of mask they wear in the classroom, and that demand of invulnerability that law students sometimes feel. And how do they break through that to really get to know people and to feel some bonds of friendship with their classmates? So we talk about that quite a bit as well. And a little bit about time management. This past year, we talked a lot about time and how we experience time, and we sort of deal with it almost as if it's a commodity that we have to manage instead of just sort of being in it. And most of the students who go have just shared with me how profoundly helpful just those 24 hours could be. They make some friends or they strengthen friendships that were pre-existing. And this year, a few of the students who went decided to kind of bring it home to Quinnipiac by starting something that also needs a better name. But right now we're just sort of calling it the open house. And so they set up 2 or 3 days a week, hours that they publicize to their fellow students and say, a few of us are just going to be in this room at this time. We're going to have, you know, coffee, tea, cookies, and come by and you can talk about anything you want or talk about nothing. And, you know, I'll need to get some debriefing from them later and find out how that's gone for them. But I'm really proud of them that just even going away for those 24 hours and talking with each other as they did, they experience things that they want to bring back to school to help fellow students feel a little more connected to each other.
I love that. How many students would you say on average participate in the 24-hour retreat?
This year, it was much larger than it had been in past years. So this year, I think we had something like 32 students who came. I was a little afraid it would be too many and we wouldn't be able to manage the group. There were a couple exercises where we had to split into separate spaces. In earlier, some years, it was very few. It might have been only 12 students. So, you know, there's kind of the question, like, how do you scale that up? Or would you even want to, mm-hmm. to try to make it for everyone? I think there's probably a maximum number that works well. And it's probably, you know, somewhere between 18 and 28 or maybe as many as we had this past time. It may have been a little large that time, but I think we could do it a couple times a year. If there were enough interest, we could go twice a year. It does require some funding, mm-hmm. and I've supported it, you know, as part of my own philanthropy to support the law school. I have supported so students can go without, you know, having to worry about paying for the lodging or the food. And then we also have a Dean's Impact Fund that's just kind of general current use, as most schools do. And I've been able to draw some funds. And also some alumni who couldn't come to the retreat decided instead to donate money to support students who wanted to go on the retreat. So I think there'll be that kind of paying it forward, mm-hmm. I hope, that may develop and make it kind of self-sustaining over time.
That's great. Well, thank you for sharing that and good luck with its continued refinement. I had asked you before we started, Was that something that you envisioned or created in response to the new professional identity formation standard for the ABA? And you indicated no, that that was not. And of course, it proceeds, far precedes the implementation of the standard. But you did talk about a new 1L course you've created to address some of the professional identity formation requirements, and that's Foundations of Practice that will be required of all 1Ls. Please tell me a little bit about that course.
Great, thank you for the question. It's going to be just a one credit course that will actually run over the course of the first year. So it will have a few sessions in the fall. It will incorporate a program we've been running since, I think, 2015 called Gateway to Practice, which is a not-for-credit kind of co-curricular program we run at the beginning of the second semester that brings in anywhere from 40 to 60 volunteer lawyers from the community who come in and work with our students in sort of small law firm groups to talk about case studies and to kind of, you know, the goal of that is to contextualize the first year curriculum a little bit and help our students see what they're learning in torts and contracts. It manifests in different ways for practicing lawyers. And the classic case is, you know, if a gym owner comes into you and says, would you review this release so I can decide if it's enough to protect me when the athletes are potentially injured in my gym? Is that a contracts problem? Is it a torts problem? Is it a, you know, real estate property problem? It's all of those, right? And so that's what we try to help our students see, the way the first year courses really look in practice. That's Gateway to Practice. And so this Foundations of Practice course will use that time. We're still going to hold that, but we'll sort of bookend it or scaffold it a little bit with some sessions in the fall semester that will be more focused on kind of how to sustain yourself through the first year, how to set a good foundation for your legal education. That's where I think I was saying we might draw on some of what we've done in the retreat and try to make that available to the entire first year class in thinking about time management and wellness and a sustainability of your professional activities in your life. And then we'll do the Gateway to Practice program. And then in the spring, we'll shift it more to, you know, interviewing, counseling, and negotiation, and do some sessions in those subject areas so that students can see, you know, again, a little bit more the realities of practice and the activities that lawyers do that are using the doctrine that they're learning in the first year. We don't have a required negotiation course in the first year, for example, but this will be a way that students could see how negotiation makes use of what they're learning in the first year. And part of why I wanted us to start the Gateway to Practice program and to run it just when we do at the beginning of the second semester is that I think it's very important for students as they start to get that first semester of grades back, that they realize that that is only a partial measure of their potential to be a good or great lawyer. And that their potential is going to turn on a whole bunch of skills and capacities and values and attitudes that just are not measured on those first year tests. So what can we work into the first year that gives them that encouragement and helps them to see, you know, there's a lot more to this than just what was tested back in December. And I hope that the Foundations course over the course of the year will kind of carry out that theme.
Great. I hope that is successful. It's such a crushing time at the beginning of that second semester when your students who have been used to being in the top of every class they've ever been in, all of a sudden, half of them have to be in the bottom half of the class. And it's very disconcerting for sure. So one other thing I wanted to ask you about is your student organization that is working on human trafficking prevention. And tell me about that and why it's significant at Quinnipiac.
Yeah, so we have a student organization called the Human Trafficking Prevention Problem, or HTPP, as we often call it. It is led by our clinical faculty member named Sheila Hare, who also teaches immigration law and teaches in our clinic and then runs the Human Trafficking Prevention Project. So this project got going when Connecticut passed a statute that required hotels and motels to train their employees on spotting and responding to signs of human trafficking. So the statute created this requirement, but provided no real means for fulfilling that requirement. And Sheila, along with a number of colleagues in the Connecticut Bar Association, the Grace Farms organization, and another organization that I think is called Love 426, but these are all human trafficking efforts. We partnered with them, and our students learned how to train hospitality workers on spotting and responding to signs of human trafficking. And that's how it began. And our students started going all around the state conducting these trainings for people in hospitality. And it's grown from there. So now they're also providing training to people in healthcare, in education. They've done legislative lobbying to try to change the vacature statute for survivors of human trafficking. And it has grown now to the point where it is the largest student organization at the law school. And students are really committed to this work. They also educate their fellow students about human trafficking, and not only, you know, sex trafficking, particularly of minors, but also labor trafficking, which could be included in this. So I'm proud of the students that it has been so much a student initiative, certainly with the help and support of faculty and lawyers outside of Quinnipiac who are partnering with them. But they've really made it into a very special program. And I think it gives many of them a way to channel their desire to be of help and to make it concrete and I think impactful.
That's outstanding. I mean, what a terrific void for them to step into, that this great legislation was enacted, but there wasn't anybody doing the training and it didn't have funding, I assume, to provide that training. So a marvelous pro bono example that your students have embraced passionately. That's really, thank you for sharing that. So I conclude all my episodes with a question that is the same for every guest. And that is, I'd love to know your predictions about the future of legal education in the coming decade. And there's kind of a two-parter to this, because on the one hand, I'd love for you to share, especially with your significant dean experience, what you think is likely to change about legal education in the coming decade. But then if there are things that you think should change in the coming decade in legal education, but maybe are not as likely to change, if you share those as well.
So if you'd asked me this question pre-pandemic, I'm sure I would have answered it differently.
And we all would have, right?
Oh my gosh, hasn't it been humbling? I mean, really. So I'm pretty sure then I might have said, well, everyone's talking about distance education and online legal education. I just don't buy it. I just don't think we can do it. I'm sure I would have said something like that. And of course, COVID has shown us, you know, how wrong we can be in some ways, but also how right we can be in other ways. So I think we have learned, and I think we will continue to learn, very effective ways to convey much of what we teach in law school virtually through distance education. And some of that will be synchronous and some will be asynchronous. And I think the quality of that education will be as great as and possibly greater than it is right now. So I think we have learned that. However, I think COVID also has taught us how important the human element of being in each other's presence and being able to see and hear each other in the same space, that's an important part of legal education, I think, particularly in the first year. Why? Because the first year is kind of the year that I don't always approve of this, but I know it's part of the whole shtick of some of my colleagues, you know, to terrorize students, to really make them work hard, to push them hard, to make them feel, wow, I'm not as smart as I thought I was. And that can be very difficult for many students. However, if they've had the chance to sort of run into their professor in the hallway, to sit over a cup of coffee with them, to kind of pick up on the nonverbal and sort of auditory cues that we get when we're in each other's presence. I know every law professor who might hear this will relate to how awful it is to tell a joke in a Zoom classroom and everyone's muted and you get no feedback on whether it landed or not.
That's for sure.
Yeah, right? So, I mean, we want to be together. So I believe, especially for schools like Quinnipiac, which stakes a lot of its identity on creating connection and community, we will need to maintain a significant on-ground element and particularly in the first year. So I think the coming decade, we'll see more virtual legal education. I believe that for schools like Quinnipiac, it will continue to need to have a sense of place and presence with each other. You know, Richard Matizar is such a great futurist about legal education. And there's a phrase that he used in talking about the future of legal education, that at least for part of the market, we would move to what he called no frills legal education. And I have really struggled with that idea because, you know, we're a young law school. We don't have a big endowment. We're tuition driven. We're trying always to economize and to deliver the most we can for the least tuition, you know, that we're imposing on our students. So no frills sounds great, but it's all a question of what do you think frills are? See, to me, something like that 24-hour retreat or the Foundations of Practice class where students get a chance to think about identity over the course of a whole year, are those frills? I mean, they're not strictly speaking necessary to learn the doctrine and to pass the bar exam. And yet I think they're really important for being a healthy, happy lawyer who's ethical and effective over the course of a career. So I just don't know exactly what a no-frills law school might be. And, you know, I think of my own experience now. I went to a flagship state law school, the University of Illinois, in the mid-80s. And the University of Illinois had a very productive, very scholarly faculty, and very little in the way of, like, student life. You know, I mean, the idea that we would have had a counselor in the building to help us deal with the stress of law school, or that even that there were lots and lots of student organizations. We just didn't really have that. I mean, we barely had a clinic. And it's just how legal education has changed so much. I think of my legal education in the mid-80s at a flagship state law school as no frills legal education. And believe me, I'm grateful the tuition was very low. But I'm sure that at the University of Illinois right now, there's much, much more going on because that's the direction that legal education has moved. And I think it will continue to move. We cannot go back to just sort of treating our students as vessels to pour doctrine into, and then they process it all and they, you know, take a bar exam and get a job at a big Chicago law firm. I mean, that's not what we're about anymore, I think, for most of us. So I think that's all a long-winded way, Patty, of saying that I think we're going to have to continue to try anyway, as I like to say, to educate the whole lawyer, to be thinking about our students' you know, cognitive work, but also their emotional work and sort of their ability to be courageous. We have to be building all of that, even though it's hard. Now, if there were something that I wish would change, but I know it's not likely to change, I do wish that the U.S. News and World Report could lose its power.
You're here.
And, you know, I sort of adopted as my own personal mantra a kind of, what would you do if U.S. News didn't exist? Like, if there's an important decision to be made, let's ask, what would you do if U.S. News didn't exist? And if you're going to come up with a different answer than that, you know, that's a problem. You really need to think that through. But I know that we are part of a profession that loves rankings and loves sort of competition and leaderboards and loves somehow to universalize things as if my little school in Connecticut could even sensibly be compared to schools that are completely different from it all over the country, each wonderful in their own way, which is also why I just want to say, as we're closing, I really, really appreciate what you're doing with this podcast, because you're giving deans an opportunity to focus on what each of us really cares about and what our schools care about and are doing well, which can all be true in a completely non-zero-sum game, right? It can be a game where it's really just all of us getting better and better together, instead of, you know, some schools gaining a few spots in the rankings while others fall. So I wish that would change. It seems unlikely to change, but I think we all just have to resolve not to let our core decision-making be too influenced by it.
Thank you. I certainly agree with you as far as the rankings go. And I appreciate your feedback about the podcast. I love that those who listen, whether they be alums of certain institutions or other deans and faculty, you know, other deans and faculty can get ideas. They can learn about the 24-hour retreat and think, would that work at my school? Is that something I should explore? Alums can learn about something that wasn't there when they were in school, and so they can be excited about it. And then potential students or even current students can learn more about what a particular law school has to offer that maybe they weren't aware of, and might increase their applications to different places, not because of a magazine, but because of programmatic differences or philosophy differences in how to approach legal education. So,
yeah, I really hope that's true. And if anybody hears this and wants more information, as you can tell, I love talking about my school. I love my school, and I would be more than happy to share ideas, outlines, syllabi, schedules of any of the things that you've heard me talk about, and just email me at jennifer.brown@qu.edu. You don't even have to spell Quinnipiac.
I was just thinking how nice that is.
qu.edu. And I'd be happy to share more with you.
Great. Thanks so much for being a guest, and best of luck as you wrap up the semester.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
This has been another episode of EdUp Legal with your host, Patty Roberts. EdUp Legal is part of the EdUp Experience podcast network, bringing you the brightest and most influential minds across higher education and beyond. Here at EdUp, we make education your business.